Okay, welcome to Silicon Sandbox. We are really excited about today's episode. I want to welcome Brent Bushnell and Eric Gradman to Silicon Sandbox.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you. And Mike, before we get off, why don't we quickly tell the viewers what Silicon Sandbox is all about, viewers and listeners, so that they can know what to expect.
So Silicon Sandbox is a video podcast where we spotlight startups local to the LA scene and spotlight also key entrepreneurs that we know in the area.
Awesome. And we cannot think of better founders and startup innovators than the two gentlemen we have today. So why don't we get right into it? Maybe Brent, the title, Brent, you are the CEO and co-founder and founder, and Eric, you are the CTO and founder, co-founder.
Yeah, you know, I feel like CTOs write white papers. I prefer Mad Inventor, personally.
Okay, all right. Chief Mad Inventor. This is perfect.
And I did attach Roustabout to my name because, you know, it is one of those things. Somebody's got to set up the tents and, you know, clean up the poop.
You guys are a bunch of clowns. And speaking of clowns, Brent, why don't you tell us a little bit about what 2-Bit Circus is, and then let's get right into it.
Yeah, well, you know, Eric and I have known each other for over a decade. You know, we're both engineers. We're actually both trained clowns. We're obsessed with circus. And, you know, we started collaborating, making interactive art and games. That stuff got bigger and bigger. Pretty soon we were doing huge parties for, you know, Amazon and the Super Bowl, and ultimately ended up opening up our own, what we call a micro amusement park. It's our own permanent facility in the middle of downtown Los Angeles. Huge space, right? Almost 40,000 square feet of entertainment, from a high-tech carnival midway, 100-seat interactive game show theater, a virtual reality arena, a full bar and restaurant. It's a ton of fun. You know, sadly, we've been closed for months now as a result of COVID. We actually closed down before we were forced to. You know, we were just looking at the numbers, just being like, gosh, this doesn't look good. But we've been continuing to innovate ever since, and you know, we see a path to being able to reopen, and we're excited for the road ahead.
And Mike Chivas and I had the pleasure of actually visiting 2-Bit Circus pre-coronavirus pandemic lockdown. So I really miss all the social interaction that we have as people. So maybe we can go into, like, how did this original thing get started? I mean, what, you guys like sit around and be like, God, we should create a micro amusement park. Like, how did that come about?
You know, it was really a natural evolution. And, you know, when Eric and I first met, you know, we were, even in 2008, pretty frustrated with the fact that everybody was on their phones and on Facebook and, like, not together live. And I think there's been no better, you know, underscore of how important live interaction is than the pandemic, right? People are going nuts not being able to hang out with their friends. And so we, even back then, we were like, gosh, let's build stuff, you know, let's use our engineering skills to build, you know, fun social games, stuff we could take to parties and get people playing together that might be total strangers. And so that's what we did, and took them to parties all around LA, and the events got bigger, and all of a sudden we were, you know, bringing, you know, VR attractions to the Super Bowl and, you know, Sundance Film Festival and all these different spots, before finally saying, you know, we've done all these events for everybody else, let's do our own event. So we did a traveling carnival for 2 years, 120,000 square foot event. So, you know, almost 2 football fields of content, which was just massive. And in fact, we were on Fox as we were launching it in Los Angeles. That was our first time down to your guys' studio. So we did that. And then after doing it in San Francisco, said, God, you know, there's clearly an appetite for this. People loved it, sold out every single day, you know, maybe we could go permanent. And that was when we started building the park. So none of it was, you know, we always knew we liked playing in public and social entertainment. We didn't know 10 years ago that it would end up as an amusement park, but we were always sort of, you know, moving in the direction of bigger and bigger.
Yeah. Yeah. To me, it did feel like a natural evolution of Steam Carnival. And I'm going to massively overstate now my involvement in Steam Carnival and describe myself as an early investor. Oh, yeah. By that, I mean I bought one of the early tickets on on the Kickstarter campaign. Thank you. And then
you
and
paid
then,
for that Kickstarter campaign.
Dude, I was so excited. I was so excited to bring my 9-year-old kid to that, because I've been to some of your parties around LA, and you kind of do like tech and physics with like an edge, right? You have like sword eaters and flamethrowers and so on.
Yeah.
And a lot of like 8-bit kind of ethos and style with the video game tech that you bring to bear. So I was so excited to bring him. And the day before your Steam Carnival, I think in Long Beach.
Yep,
do I have
Long
that
Beach.
Right?
Exactly. San
Pedro. He jumped over a fence running away from girls and broke his arm in like three different places.
That's our kind of nerd right there. Running away from girls.
I know you might appreciate that.
My heart goes out to you, kid.
That's the only reason I never got to see a Steam Carnival in real life. But I did go to a couple of parties at your facility in like the downtown, not the one you're at now, but the one you're at before, the brewery building.
The brewery,
right?
We still have a space there. It's our fabrication facility, but that was our headquarters for a decade.
It's a great space.
I'll say if there's one thing that kind of ties together everything that Brent and I have been doing together for the past 10 years, we've tried to be bulwarks against two trends that we see. One is that technology is getting awesome and no one's using it to bring people together, right? There's so many ways that we can use technology to bring people together. And the other trend is that, you know, people just don't go out all that much anymore, you know?
Right.
There's too many things to do in your house. We want to give people an amazing experience out.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, so let's go there. So we are in the middle of a historic pandemic. You know, I have a family with a young toddler at home, and you know, it's sort of scary to go out and, you know, and do that kind of social interaction that is missing and that we all sort of crave. So, you know, does what you just say, Eric, go against the reality of today? Like, how do you reconcile the fact that we've been at home having cabin fever for 6 months, while the core of the mission for you is actually the opposite of bringing people together physically? Like, how do we understand those two things?
Our motto has been bringing people together elbow to elbow to play, and that's clearly not something that the world is letting us do right now. We are going to be there for people when they are allowed to go out and play elbow to elbow. But in the meantime, you know, we realize that we can still use technology to bring people together, even if they can't go out to do it. So I think we're applying what we learned in building this park and in entertaining people in groups over 10 years. We're applying it to the new world that we're in. And there are some great disadvantages. You can no longer smell the people you're playing with. But there are great advantages too. I mean, we can do some things with technology that we never would have expected to be able to do.
And I'd say that all the stuff that we've been building post-pandemic is stuff we want to exist even when this is over. You know, we'd always imagined extending some of the experiences into the home. You know, we know that you can't come out all the time, but we'd like to be able to be there, you know, to play with you, you know, over the long term. So sometimes you can come live, great. We'll give you a different experience if you can just stay at home. And so, you know, being able to sort of meet people where they are at different phases. Live is the best, the highest resolution, the most exciting, but it's also the one that requires, you know, geo-co-location and, you know, a bunch of other things that can be hard to organize.
I think there's so much pent-up demand for Two-Bit Circus when this whole thing is over, hopefully soon. But there's also a demand, I think, probably a rising demand for Two-Bit Circus remote. Mm-hmm. In that I'm in the highly unusual position for the first time ever in my career where I have 4 or 5 employees on my team who I've never met. And all we do all day is Zoom, right? So there's none of that corridor conversation that Steve and I were used to when we worked out of the Fox lot or the KTTV facility. There's no water cooler conversation. And I'm explaining to people quite a lot that normally I would run into our content people and we'd have great conversations. I'd run into cameraman or meteorologists. But now, if I'm not in a Zoom call with you talking about a specific project, forget about it. So we're talking in terms of like team dynamics and team culture about putting together at least one Zoom call, optional, maybe late on a Friday afternoon, where people just come together and no one's allowed to talk about work. And we're talking about, right, but what are we going to do on that call? Because we don't want to just sit around and have it be awkward. Yeah. And I'm thinking about trivia night or even bingo. And then I happened to see your Two-Bit Circus remote sizzle. I was like, that's it.
Cool.
That's exactly what we need.
Let me tell you, I remember with great joy my very first Zoom happy hour when the pandemic began. I remember thinking to myself, oh gosh, this is great. My happy hour, I can still be with my friends even though we're all stuck at home. And I remember the second one, and the second one did not fill me with the same level of glee. And basically, it's been a downward slope ever since. And we built 2-Bit Circus Remote to, I mean, address Zoom fatigue. People are online on video all day. So much of the day you spend staring at yourself in a little window on a screen, like I'm doing right now. It's like staring in the mirror all day. And everyone's got these slack-jawed expressions. And we wanted to take what we loved about entertainment that we did in the park, that game show feel, somebody up on stage entertaining you, not passively. You're not going to sit there passively being entertained, because this is 2020. We don't do nothing passively anymore. Even if you're watching television, you have your phone in your hand and you're tweeting something, right? But what we've done with 2-Bit Circus Remote is try and, you know, bring that experience of being out with friends into your home and let you play it with friends, family, and the entire world. And it's really addressing exactly the problem that you've singled out there.
You know, so, I think one of the challenges with Zoom also is it's so easy to sort of hive off the two or three of us to have a conversation in normal life. But on Zoom, it's like if we're on a 30-person Zoom, you know, one person's kind of holding court, you know, and that's a hard way to sometimes to get a word in edgewise.
Yeah. So how do we? I mean, look, let's say some skeptics are like, dude, I cannot watch another video Zoom, you know, thing anymore in my day. Like, you know, eyes are blurry. Like, I'm going to nauseate if I have another one of these things. So how do we get over that? Like, what makes your thing different that I don't get this anxiety attack of yet another Zoom call?
So one key part is you're not always on video with ours, right? You are watching a stream of a host. The host is inviting panelists at times, and those panelists, they get on video for a contained round, and then they'll get off video and you're back to, you know, on your couch, relaxing a little bit more. You're still participating, but you're not having to sort of be on, right? You know, Mike, you said you guys are going to have a happy hour, but nobody's going to talk about work. But, you know, just the idea of being on your camera again is sort of like, oh man, I got to put a shirt on again. I got to, you know, somebody's going to put on makeup. You know, it's like, it's just, there's a lift there. And I think part of that is sort of is
we've gotten feedback from, you know, we're obviously selling this to corporate clients. We're running events. We're running one just a couple hours. And we've gotten a request many, many times from people who are arranging these events. Hey, can we put everybody who's playing this game all in one big Zoom room? And we always say yes, but consider not, you know, consider giving them the opportunity to do something that doesn't require them to look good, sound good, pretend to be interested. Let them be entertained. Let them participate. And absolutely, we can do it. Like we've built a whole system where we can create tiny little breakout rooms. So you and two people from your team who you may have never met before get the opportunity to play a game together in a tiny breakout room environment. But then that breakout room dissolves and you're back in public. You're back, you know, alone playing a game against everybody being entertained by that host.
Yeah, you know, this is actually, maybe I haven't gotten out much, but it's actually interesting. I have not heard an idea yet about non-video sort of real-time interaction or entertainment. Maybe there's something there. I think that's actually really interesting. It's sort of old. It's going back in some ways in technology.
Totally. But it's retro. It's 8-bit. Retro. 8-bit Zoom. Like,
yep.
Maybe that's the right balance, is that the video is not always on.
Well, and you know, you look at things like Twitch and YouTube and you know, the comments can be so, you know, interesting, and there's lots of stuff going through it. But you know, we want to just have some of that interaction jump out of the comments and be stuff really in your face that you know, would allow, you know, really encourage a lot of interaction. You know, so that really part of the fun of the show is participating in the show, is creating the content that informs the host, you know, and the panelists, and sort of having this back and forth relationship between host and audience.
I got to say, we've gotten this far in the podcast. We haven't even really explained what being on 2-Bit Circus Remote is all about.
Do it, Eric.
So, you know, once upon a time, back before the end times that we're all living through, we had this space in 2-Bit Circus called Club 01. And it was our game showroom. And people would sit at tables and they'd eat food and drink cocktails. And up on stage, there'd be a host. And that host would be asking trivia questions or leading everybody through a wine tasting or pretending to be a nun who asked, well, I'm not even going to try to explain that one, but anyway, it was great. And what we were trying to create there was it was like you were in a game show. It's like you'd gone to see Jeopardy, but you got to play, even though you were sitting at your table with some friends, you got to play. We've moved that online. And so to participate in what we've created now, 2-Bit Circus Remote, our online version, is that you're watching a live stream of a host. And that host is sitting oftentimes either at our park in our studio or at home and asking trivia questions, asking preference questions, using some of the mechanics that people love from many game shows past that we all know and love, and tweaking those mechanics to work online. So you may be asking sort of Mad Lib style people to fill in blanks, and then that creates a script that the host or maybe one of the panelists will read. Trivia questions are live scored. We're breaking people up into groups, video groups where they're answering questions together and getting points or failing to get points, depending on who wrote the question. And it's a piecemeal show. You know, you're doing something, and then you're doing something else, and then you're doing something else, and then you're doing something else. It's not the same thing throughout.
Describe
tons
it as
of variety.
Variety game show.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's nothing I hate saying more in this world than, Brent, you were right. But Brent, you were right. For years, when we were in the park, he's been pushing us all to find experiences that could live both inside the park and outside the park. Because I think you always saw the possibility for a 2-bit circus that sort of, it was diffuse.
The porous, the walls were porous, or sort
yeah,
of.
Yeah, exactly.
Like where the park ended and you know your home began, we sort of wanted to be able to ping pong people back and forth between the two. And, you know, I think part of this is being able to, you know, have an ongoing relationship. You might be able to come live a couple days a week, or, you know, a couple days a month, but the rest of the time you're not missing, you know, your favorite weekly show.
Yeah, it sounds like showmanship as a service. That's your SaaS offering.
It's good. I love that.
It works.
As good as it would sound to say that as, you know, as soon as the pandemic started, we leapt into action creating, and in fact we did, but for completely different reasons. This was kind of my sanity project for the first couple weeks of the pandemic. You know, as soon as we couldn't go to the office, as soon as we weren't entertaining people live in the park, I said, well, let's do something cool on the internet. And we created the first version of this, which was called Fun in Exile. And Fun in Exile was a COVID-19 themed show documenting the ridiculous, inadvisable things that people were doing in reaction to the pandemic. So if you recall, in reaction to lockdown, people were doing all sorts of things like carrying their fish around because technically they were walking their pet. If they weren't walking their pet, they couldn't leave their apartments. So trivia questions about all that silly stuff that people were doing. And then it just dragged on. The pandemic just dragged on and on and on and on. And it became clear that gimmick wasn't enough. But what we had created in the process was a really powerful platform for entertaining people, both the public who used to come and have a great time at 2-Bit Circus, but also corporate customers who have no place to go, right? No one is doing real events. Nothing is open. What are you going to do? You got to entertain your people.
And, you know, Steve, I'll go back to something else you mentioned around, you know, getting folks off their screens. And, you know, we love physicality, and our park is, you know, almost 40,000 square feet of odd controllers and all sorts of weird ways to interact. And I think in this COVID lockdown environment, there's also an opportunity for home delivered kits that go together with that content. And so we've explored a lot of different, you know, ways to play. And I loved seeing Vampire Pizza, which launched right after the pandemic, where you ordered a pizza and you got a little escape room in a box, and it was delivered by a vampire. And you know, this was a 45-minute entertainment experience that you sort of did over dinner. And it was this kind of turnkey entertainment solution that I really thought was, you know, a great, you know, use of the time. And I think also another, you know, a great opportunity here. And you know, when folks are apart, you can still sort of play games together.
Brent, I just know that the moment is, we are not too long from the moment where I am driving around in my pickup truck, running a paper route around Los Angeles.
You know, with our clown delivery.
Because tonight I'm going to be answering customer service request calls on the online show. Now I'm going to be doing the paper route. Oh my God, this pandemic is, it's like 10 years have gone backwards.
Yeah. It's like the subscription box model, whatever, the Birch Box or, you know, whatever for entertainment. That's actually another cool kind of concept. But look, you guys obviously have great chemistry together. And one of the things we like to do on the show is, like, you know, our previous guest, Patrick Kahn of Papaya, talked about finding your co-founder. Mm. And in a more typical tech startup, you usually have a business founder and then a technical co-founder. Tell us a little bit about the way you guys met and your decision to partner up, because that's a substantial commitment to each of you, and making the wrong decision could be a really a matter of success and failure.
We've done both of those.
How did you guys choose to work together? And tell us about the co-founding part of the story.
Sure. You want to start, Brent?
Sure. We were lucky enough to have a friend of ours, Doug Campbell, introduced us, together with nine or so other nerds, in 2008. And that night, Eric and I just started collaborating, making our first project together. You know, that with this happy hour had happened and everybody was done. And so he and I were like, God, you want to make that too? Let's make this thing. And it was an interactive whiteboard that would capture what you were drawing and then project a physics simulation that would bounce off of everything that you'd drawn. And we had fun building that and stayed up till 4 a.m, you know, and then built another thing the next week. And actually that thing is still in the park now. Those huge track balls, that was a prototype we made with Eric's circus ball at the time. He literally had that for being a clown in the circus. And so we just kept making new projects, challenged ourselves to make something new every month. And, you know, pretty soon a year had gone by and we made all this stuff and all of a sudden we were taking it to other, to parties. And I would say kind of, at every step of the way, you know, I saw what a workaholic Eric was, and I'm a total workaholic, and there we were showing up early mornings for, load in and closing it out late at night. And you sort of start to understand what someone's made of. And I think, in that we ended up with a great friendship and a great business relationship.
Yeah, I think we had chemistry first and then business second, because when we met, we were not looking to start a business together. That was not our intent. Our intent was to just build cool stuff together. And at the time, I was happily employed and so was Brent. And it took a while before we decided, we've got something here. We can make this happen as a real business. That was the first of several that we started together. You asked another question about, these companies often have a business co-founder and a technical co-founder. I don't feel like we started so bifurcated back then. We Brent is a great engineer and I'm a passable businessman. And I think we both started doing everything, because that's what startup founders do. And over time, we've specialized, and we've specialized to things that we enjoy doing and we're good at. So, and that was a very natural process. It never felt like it was forced in any way.
Yeah, agreed.
So what was that one moment? Because, a lot of our listeners may have great ideas, and maybe there are a couple of folks that they like to do something with, but it's really hard taking that step to actually quitting what you're doing that, supposedly giving you the income that you need and taking the plunge into the unknown. So,
I think
that's pretty scary, right? For most people. How did that happen for you guys?
The biggest one that I would challenge even that framing is as one big step. In that, think of it more like 1,000 steps, mm-hmm. And really the moment, I still remember, Eric, when you were like, I guess I'm going to quit my job with the money we just made, doing contract work, and it was like we had, it started as a hobby and we were getting paid nothing and we were doing a ton of work because we loved it. And so that was fine. And then some people were like, hey, we'll pay you for that. And we were like, really? Like, we were just doing that for free, but okay. And then, as the projects got bigger and the gigs got bigger, it sort of started to rationalize our ability to stop working on other things. And so I think that, but that tipping point is important. It's almost like firing a neuron, it doesn't just fire, it collects energy before it finally fires. And so we were in that same boat of, and so I think for people who are considering doing something, try it tomorrow. Try the simplest, smallest version. If you haven't even built it, just make the marketing materials and try to sell it. Try to get anybody to get excited about it. And I think one thing that early entrepreneurs make a mistake with is they think, oh my God, this is my idea. I need to be really protective of it because someone's gonna steal it. And that's the wrong headspace. Because unless you spent like $1 billion on R&D and it's like a provable thing someone wants to steal, the more likely thing is they don't care at all and you can't even get somebody's attention. You know, and so you really don't be precious with your idea. Tell everybody, get feedback. And really, you know, when you go and tell it to someone, there's two kinds of people. Those who are capable and those who are incapable. The incapable ones can't steal it, right? They're not gonna do a good job if they steal it. The capable ones already have a ton of stuff they're working on, you know? And so it's like, they're not gonna drop everything to steal your thing. So, you know, and chances are you bring some special thing to that, to your project that would be hard for somebody else to replicate.
As long as we're philosophizing about how to start companies, you know, there's a line of advice out there that goes, you know, if you're thinking about building something, don't wait, just build it, go do it, make it happen. You can do it. Just sit down, start coding, get your first prototype out there, release it before it's ready. And that is fantastic advice. And there's another line of thinking that goes, you know what? Find some customers first, make sure you're solving the right problem. Yeah. Do everything you need to do to validate that your approach is correct and that you're not just engineering for its own sake. And that advice is also totally correct. And if you have two people, one of whom can solve one of those problems and one of whom can solve the other of those problems, then you're going to be successful, because the fight that arises between those two mindsets will lead to something that solves somebody's problem in a way that was built by someone who was passionate about solving the problem.
The product market fit, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Which is usually an evolution. You evolve to the product market. Right. Well, chances are the thing you have in your head now that you're like, should I drop everything and start this, is not the thing that is ultimately the product market fit. You converge on that by sort of trying and failing.
Yeah, like very organically. And I feel like the expression product market fit does not at all do justice to the products that you guys have done, right? And it'd be hard to imagine what you were going to do 12 years into the future when you met in 2008. Yeah.
Product market fit is a state of being, not a process. And the process is messy and it's fun and it's rewarding and it gets ugly and there's, you know, blood and code and sweat smeared everywhere. But you know what? Like, when you get it, then you've almost got it.
So talk about that. I mean, look, you know, I was part of founding, you know, a couple of companies before. I know Mike Shivas is also, and obviously you guys have, you know, there are dark moments where, you know, it feels like there's nobody that knows what you're going through because it's so tough and it's so unique. And maybe that time is now, I don't know, with the pandemic, but what were, if you can remember like your biggest challenge that the two of you had to work through in your, you know, decade together, is there one moment that sort of stands out and what can you tell us about it?
I mean,
how long do you have?
I mean, the number of things that have been like existential threats where the whole thing almost all blew up into a million pieces.
Hey, can we talk about the marble tablet? Because I feel like that's a good one.
That's a great one. We did a lot of consulting. We were consulting for companies for years. And it was, you know, as we were evolving to what the company was that we wanted to have, you know, we didn't exactly know what it was. And so we were taking contract work to basically pay for our experimentation. And so our favorite projects either paid for R&D, paid for marketing, us as a partner rather than as some faceless vendor, or they were high margin enough that we could sort of buy that stuff. And it would, you know, we could do an hour of consulting work and that would pay for an hour of building our own stuff. And so one of those early projects was a huge project, really, exciting and interesting. And we did a ton of work and scaled up a huge team. And at one point, all of a sudden, they just stopped paying us. They sort of just like went silent. And we were like, oh my God, this is crazy terrible. We have not been around very long. We have no savings, you know, like we owe money right now. Like this is the company's gonna die in no time. And we went and saw, you know, big lawyers, and they were like, gosh, yeah, you know, you did the work and they didn't pay you. Like, this is an open and shut case. You should have the money in 2 years. And we were like, 2 years? We're gonna have 2 weeks. You know, this is like, that's just not even possible. And so we, you know, thought. We were like, well, how are we going to get their attention? And, you know, because maybe they, you know, they're not reading our emails. We're like, how do we get their attention?
Let me just set you up here by saying we had limited assets. We had about $20 in the bank. We had a laser cutter and we had a 6-pack of beer. And we figured we were going to make do with what we had.
Nice.
So we wrote a very nice letter, very respectable letter, and etched it on a slab of marble and sent that to them and said, hey, by the way, we're over here. We'd love, you know, to get paid. And we
went into debt to FedEx that overseas, by the way.
FedEx and marble is very expensive.
Overnight, no less.
But we got paid in 2 weeks.
That's awesome. So when you said a tablet, I thought you were talking about the iPad variety. You guys are talking about like a marble tablet.
Three quarters of an inch thick. That is a letter that lands with a thud on somebody's desk. It does not hide underneath other paperwork. That rises to the top.
So what did the tablet say?
It just said that we love solving hard problems. We've helped you solve hard problems for a long time.
And it was a lawyer letter. It was just standard lawyer letter. You know?
We'd appreciate being able to do that. There's just this one little middling issue of all this money you owe us. So please pay that. And then we can go back to doing great stuff together.
And they paid us. That was basically like seed investment in what we wanted to do. But of course, that ran out eventually too. So that's another dark story. But whatever. This is the fun one.
That's an amazing story. I think we're like, this is a podcast that breaks news. That one, I mean, if for any of the listeners out there who somebody's not paying you money or you're in some kind of situation, try etching it on marble tablets.
Get a laser cutter.
That is amazing. So, I mean, you guys, I think are either native Los Angeles, or Angelenos and this podcast is all about sort of the LA scene. And so have you guys been in LA all your life? And what is this, you know, what does LA mean to you guys? Is this a good place to start a business? You know, do you like it here? Like tell us about the mayor may be listening.
Eric, why don't you go first?
Well, I was going to say, you have perspective on this, being the person who's lived anywhere other than Los Angeles. So why don't you start?
Okay. So I grew up in Silicon Valley and was up there for 20 years before coming down here with a brief stint in Colorado. And, you're raised in Northern California to hate it down here. It's like it's in the water. And I remember getting down here and being like, this place is awesome. Like, what are they talking about? I think for...
We're raised with great indifference toward Northern California. We couldn't care less. Perfect. We don't even know where you are.
I love that. That's all the better that it's just one way, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, I think it's an incredible time to start a company in LA. It's really, you know, the thing that I love so much about LA is it's like 90 cities, right? It's not just one city. There's so much going on. And the number of times Eric and I have gone to order some part or buy something that we need for a project, the chances that company is actually based in Los Angeles are actually pretty good, you know? And so in terms of being able to just sort of have access to experts and gear and, you know, all the different things that you might need in order to be able to start a company, and also audience, you know, lots of different communities and, you know, ways to be able to test and iterate things that would be hard to do anywhere else. All the fun, you know, the sheer number of engineers that are graduated here every year and, the intersection of gaming and content creation.
We started our company in downtown Los Angeles, which I see as the intersection of two well-defined axes. Go down the 10, you get engineering software and design and business acumen. Go up the 5 and you get theme park, theatrical, and people who can build with their hands. And, you know, right at the intersection of those two freeways, those two talent pools, there's downtown Los Angeles. It was really a perfect place to start 2-Bit Circus because we've drawn so heavily on both types of people. I love this city. Man, I've lived here my whole life. You could not pay me enough to go anywhere else. No pandemic is going to move me into an Ohio farmhouse.
No, hey, no offense to the listeners in Ohio.
In Ohio.
But
enjoy it. I'm staying here. That's why I picked it,
why does LA get such a bad rap? Like, why is it that Brent
who's giving LA a bad rap?
You know, Steve, I actually did some research on this. And for LA, for Northern California specifically, it goes back to when LA was really a startup city and it was stealing water from Northern California, it was stealing tourism. There was sort of, you know, LA as the upstart had nothing to lose. And so everybody was sort of like, yep, it's great down here. You know, what's everybody complaining about? But Northern California, they sort of had this competitor that they didn't have before. And so that was sort of, I think, the original origin.
Is that still a thing, Brent? I haven't lived in San Francisco for a long time since dot-com 1.0, in fact. And I remember it was a thing then, but LA has changed so much in the past 20 years.
I think you're right. I don't actually think that it is much of a thing anymore.
I hope not.
I still need some time to see old school, you know, Bay Area folks, but I think for the most part, a lot of them are moving down here.
Does your comment or do your comments apply if you're not a entertainment related startup as well?
Manufacturing products, fashion, you know, I mean, just listed out, you know, biotech, you know, down in San Diego, you know, there is really, you would have a hard time finding, you know, an industry that you know, doesn't have some kind of excellence.
Okay. So where do you guys live in LA? We got LA listeners. Where can they find you hanging out?
As far apart as it is humanly possible to live and still be in Los Angeles at this point.
Yeah. We both lived in downtown for ages and in fact started 2Bit out of my loft, which was underneath Eric's loft. Now I live on the west side.
I live in Eagle Rock. Go Eagle Rock.
Okay. I grew up in Arcadia nearby.
Awesome. So.
Okay, great. So LA, good stuff. You guys think it's a good place to go. Yeah. You know, I think, so what do you not like about LA? You got to go there. Keep it real for us. What is one thing you think you can change? And you can't say traffic. Well, what else?
Positivity rate and percentage of number of positive cases per 100,000 is about the biggest problem I have with Los Angeles right now.
Okay. All right. Well, let's put the pandemic aside.
You know, Steve, I do think that there's a, you know, California has frustrated me in general with the pandemic recently. I think that there was great leadership shown in how quickly we closed down. And they, you know, Garcetti, Newsom, they saw the numbers and they locked down fast. And that was awesome. I am disappointed in how reopening has happened. And I think that, you know, you look at other states where they set out a set of guidelines and people either rise to the level of those guidelines or they don't. And if you don't, they take your health permit away, right? But what's happened by just sort of blanket locking people off, it doesn't allow any innovation. And you want to allow people to act in their own self-interest, right? And then the reason we have the health department is to say, you're doing something not safe, you're not allowed to do that anymore. And yet instead we're sitting on our hands and, you know, there are lots of ways in which 2Bit could be operating that would be very safe. We have a full-time president, a full-time general manager, a full-time HR lead who've done nothing but study COVID for the last 6 months. And the fact that we're not allowed to open in a way that we know to be safe, frankly, safer than dine-in, is infuriating because it's costing hundreds of jobs. We're not going through the iteration that we need to in order to be able to converge on a solution. And, you know, and so the world is just passing us by. And you know, I really feel like it's a great disservice.
No, it's interesting. No, it's, I think coming from your perspective, that really, you know, hits home, I think, because you are literally shut down. You are not allowed to open
illegal
up your park
for us to open. Yeah, exactly.
Right. By the way, what would happen if you opened up? I don't know what the ramifications
are. They would literally take our health permit. Mm-hmm. But the problem is they would be doing that because we're just in a category that's not allowed to reopen. Barring the fact that if we set up a bunch of stuff in the parking lot and to where it was safe to eat, you know, we've shown that, you know, outdoor is fine. That's why we've got, you know, dine out open. But something like an escape room, what we call story rooms, are de facto safer than dine-in. But when dine-in had been opened, escape rooms were still not allowed to be opened just because they are misclassified in phase 3. So it, you know, that single tiny little bureaucratic, you know, tidbit doesn't allow us to reopen. And that is really problematic because it makes the difference, you know, on a lot of cases between the success of a business and a failure. We will survive, but I know lots of folks that won't. And so there's this huge long-term damage, long-term impact that, you know, is completely avoidable. And that's the part that drives me nuts. It's so avoidable. And yet here we are, you know, September sitting on our hands.
Okay. Well, Mayor Garcetti, if you are listening.
I love Mayor Garcetti and they've actually been super helpful. This is really Gavin. This is Newsom. I went from Garcetti through to the county and everybody is pegging their standards to the state. And so this is really state level.
Okay, Governor Newsom. We've upped the ante to the statewide elected officials.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Well, look, you talked about, because I can't think of two sort of more creative guys than you guys about like entertainment and what that actually means. So, I love like your philosophies on things and, you know, Brent, just to, you know, I from what I know of your personal background, your father was actually the founder of Atari as well as Chuck E. Cheese, which we can talk about, you know, in a little bit. But, you know, like you have a personal pedigree about seeing what entertainment, you know, as a category definer in the family. And obviously, Eric, you bring a ton of unique creative and highly technical and sophisticated background to entertainment. But like what is at the heart of entertainment? And do you guys have like a philosophy of like what at the end of the day, you know, amusement and entertainment is? And, you know, we have some thoughts about that.
You know, in the most extreme moments, you know, I do think of us as even potentially being in wellness, right? You know, I mean, people want, you know, play is fundamental, right? People love to play. We are social animals. You know, again, you can see with the pandemic, people going nuts because we can't get together again. And so play and amusement is a very natural and, you know, a very natural thing. And I think sometimes gets is thought of as frivolous. Oh, play, that's the last thing. You know, there's work first, and there's family, and play is sort of way over here. But it really is, you know, is a fundamental human need. And so I think that, you know, it's part of happiness. It's a core part of happiness. It's a core part, you know, you look at the blue zones, all the places where people lived the longest and they had tight social networks, you know, real live in-person social networks, not social networks, you know, over the internet. And so, you know, for me, entertainment is not only that valuable thing for happiness and sociability, but it's also this incredible kind of testing ground and proving ground for creating things that are compelling. And you know, video games have been proven to be, you know, to drive motivation. We have literally the very first drug that was just FDA cleared that is a video game, right? You put no pill in your body. You literally are prescribed a video game. And we're gonna see, you know, in VR, we're already seeing its effectiveness in training. You learn things faster. You will exercise harder. You know, we can use these tools not just for entertainment, but now therapy and fitness and learning and retraining. There's all these different applications. And when it's built for entertainment, it's a low risk, right? The worst thing that could happen is if somebody didn't have fun. But ultimately, once you've tried and true that equipment, you can start to say, hey, we can put this in a hospital. We can use this in a surgery simulation. We can you know, save cadavers and train, you know, students faster. You know, I mean, the biggest deployment of VR
What are you saving the cadavers for?
Cadavers are expensive, right? And so there's some great, VR simulators that allow you to, you know, operate on, you know, 100 bodies before you ever do a real but the biggest deployment of VR is for Walmart's training, their internal corporate training.
VR has unfortunately never materialized as the entertainment market I hoped it would be. I would love to have gone from video games into VR, and unfortunately it didn't kind of hit the way I wanted it to, but I've been keeping close tabs on it, and it is starting to expand into the B2B space, which is very, very interesting. But
you have a Quest? You have an Oculus Quest?
I actually have a Vive. I've had a Vive for a couple of years now. As soon as I experienced room scale, I was like, okay, this is the future of entertainment. But then ultimately, unsurprisingly, I'm kind of an early adopter right? And the market isn't ready to strap that thing onto their face. And one of the things I found so attractive about Two-Bit Circus is that you have the Vive rooms. I was in a one of your VIP cabanas playing a Vive right before the pandemic hit, which I feel very grateful for. But you also have these kind of augmented reality, physical, virtual experiences. So talk about something like the Dr. Botcher game, which is a physical game that creates this really funny augmented reality through electronics and touchscreen devices. How do you go about playtesting something like that to figure out, you know, is this going to be fun, and how do we just nail it, and how do we polish it so that it's completely unforgettable?
Playtest 5 times a day, trying something new every single time, every single day of the week for weeks and months.
In software, the upside is that it's the materials are very malleable, right? But with something physical like Dr. Botcher, I was thinking, like, how do they, you know, if they have to construct something, because it's too big for 3D printing, right? If these guys have to get material scientists in here and construct something that's like room scale, and then it doesn't work, does it just end up in the ash heap?
I'll tell you that downstairs in the park, there is a discarded, dismembered mannequin body that I bought on Amazon for $49, sawed up with a little circular saw, and put various pieces of electronics in while we were developing this thing. But to your question about being able to, I'm going to sort of rephrase it and say, like, prototype with matter. It's very easy to prototype with software. You just change a line of code here and change a line of code there. What I think my biggest contribution to Two-Bit Circus has been over the years is creating systems for getting hardware and software to be equally malleable in our games. It is difficult. No doubt, it is difficult to put a bunch of sensors on a body, but with good software platforms, with good show control, with good software design, it is possible to make it as easy to change that game and prototype and test new ideas in a whole room full of hardware. You don't want to have to sit down and be recompiling 5 different things on 20 different computers and, you know, keyboards every which way. No, you sit at a table with a keyboard and you change the entire room. And by extension, I can sit at a keyboard and I can change the entire park. To me, that entire park is just another story room. It's just another interactive element. And all the pieces are connected to one another, and all of them can be used together to create new experiences that emerge.
We at the toy company, all the electronics and mechanical engineers and material scientists used to call the process, I think you're describing, kit bashing. And they would go out and they would buy other toys and they would just rip them apart. And they would take the electronics and just stuff them together, and they'd get the thing that would do physically very close to the thing that they wanted the toy to do. Yeah. And I remember seeing them do that, and they would just do it like all the time, like it was no big deal. Spend like $200 on toys, smash it to pieces.
Totally.
And kit bash something new from it.
Well, look, Dr. Botcher is at its core a room scale version of the game of Operation. And so it shouldn't surprise you one bit that the first version of the dude at the center of the room upon whom you are operating was the board game Operation. And it took a while before that turned into first a $59 mannequin and then into a beautifully designed puppet that was custom built and, you know, sort of matched the aesthetics of the room. You got to start somewhere, you know, you hit bash until you're ready to make your own.
I don't know, Eric, when you were talking, it like frighteningly reminded me of an episode of Westworld where you are like controlling the whole park with, you know, lifelike people. I mean,
so true. You know, and I would say that one of the other things that we've done really from the beginning is involve the players, you know, and so we test early. We have what we call our beta nights, which is, you know, something we do at least every quarter, where whenever we've got new stuff to test, we invite other creators to test their stuff. And on some Tuesday night, we'll invite thousands of people who like to be a part of the process to come down and give us feedback. And you know, these are particularly folks who don't care if they get a splinter. They don't care if it's a little buggy. They just want to be there to try something new. And that's really helpful. The sooner we can get, you know, it exposed to people, the more diverse of the inputs we're able to get and start to really converge on where the fun is.
And do you guys have some kind of physical analytics game where you're actually tracking people around the park and seeing like, oh, this person swiped their card here, here, and here. And then do you use that data, or is your ethos and your philosophy more about, we just talk to people and we can see they were having a good time over here? So
we certainly talking to people is the most valuable form of feedback. The kind of data that comes from a small data set provided by a single park isn't enough to really make a huge change. Look, we can look at numbers at the end of the month and we can change the balance of games in the park, of course. But in terms of changing game mechanics based on how people are playing the games, the data sets aren't quite large enough for that, I would say. I don't know how you feel about that, Brent.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you described is really, you know, sort of classic qualitative and quantitative. We'll look and see what are people buying, you know, what are we getting great throughput on, you know, and then also the face-to-face, hey, how was your experience? Did you love it? You know, NPS scores, that kind of stuff.
You know, Steve, I want to jump back to something you mentioned a moment ago about the analogy to Westworld. It turns out that humans are totally programmable. They have an easy to operate API. And you first have to gain access. And the way you gain access is by making them laugh and showing them a good time. And, you know, I come at game design not as a game designer. I don't, as Brent will make fun of me all the time, I don't even play all that many games. I approach it from behavioral economics and psychology. And I see it as a process of tuning systems to achieve some kind of result. And the result we're trying to achieve is that people come back, people play more, you know, and we can manipulate people. And there's no other way of putting it, really. We're manipulating people into having a good time. And that's what good entertainers do. Good entertainers do it with showmanship. They do it with good staging and lighting and sound and theatrics. Game designers do it with game mechanics and graphics. And, you know, we're using all those tools and techniques wherever we can to just achieve this desired result, which is smiles on people's faces.
So, Eric, are you a robot or a human being?
I am a robot.
Okay.
I was manufactured on planet Zorthrax and sent here in a small pod. I landed 17 and a half years ago, and don't let this appearance fool you.
Fantastic. Well, you know, you mentioned the word game mechanics, and I was exposed to that term, you know, when I was in Silicon Valley, when I was a venture capitalist, because that term comes out a bit, you know, whether it's a new social, even a social network with game mechanics in it, or an actual game that have game mechanics. So for those of the listeners who don't know, what do you mean by game mechanics? Like, can you guys give us a little, like, what is game mechanics 101? What do you actually mean by that? Yeah, I think it was a fascinating concept for me.
Go for it, Brent.
Yeah, I mean, you know, game mechanics are the little units of compulsion loops that exist inside of games. You know, a few mechanics together make a game. So, you know, you will give people coins for having performed an action well, right? You've got this reward mechanic. You will only give them so many lives as they die. So you're gonna, you know, you're gonna punish them with restarting the level and having to start over again once you've gone out of your, you know, lost all your lives. You know, the game mechanics are the fundamental tools that sort of make the game work, the balancing forces that make the game work. You look at a chessboard, the rules are super simple. You know, but those rules are what allow for this massive amount of complexity to come out of all the different strategies that happen with games, you know, with chess. And so you're really looking for a balance of game mechanics. You know, a great game running too long, you know, it all of a sudden is feels like work. You know, you got to tune up that game mechanic, you know, tighten up that timer and you know, give them a little bit of a break, you know, around boundary is really about taking a break and being able to catch your breath for a second, you know, before you plow back into doing the activity again. So you're really trying to balance, you know, what that people feeling challenged, but not so challenged that they're frustrated, and not too little challenged that they're bored. You know, that flow state where you're sort of right in the middle, you've got your balance, you've got your game mechanics balance.
Sorry, Steve.
No, go ahead.
A follow-on question about that. I've done exactly what you're describing. It could be incredibly time-consuming, right? It's a lot of fun, right, to just come out with iteration after iteration and then, you know, give it to your audience and your customers and see how they react. But 2-Bit Circus, every single thing at the park doesn't come from you, right? You have this great kind of portfolio of experiences where some of them are large kiosk scale versions of well-known virtual reality games. Some of them are kiosks that it looks like Eric the Robot created for the park. And then there are other things that are truly unique. Like, I've never seen anything like it. And one of the things I was drawn to was this crazy game that looks like it's a single row of LED lights that goes from the... I think I was the only person who noticed that.
It's,
and my son was like, game of the park. What are you even doing? And I was like, my 8-bit ethos came back, mm-hmm. and I was like, I got to figure this thing out. And I played all the way through it. So I'm probably the only person in the high score table.
So that, I'm so glad that, you know that game.
That is my favorite game in the park, yeah. because it's just pure game mechanic. There's no flash. There's no graphic. It's just a bunch of LEDs
one
and an
pixel
idea.
Wide.
One pixel wide.
So yeah. how do you source all of that creativity if you're not making all of it yourself? Like, where does it come from?
It's called Line Wobbler, made by our incredible game maker, Robin Baumgartner. And, you know, there's really three ways that things get into the park. One is we make it, you know, with about half the stuff in there, you know, came out of our team and you know, the years that Eric and I have collaborated together. The next set are collaborations, where we'll work together with a third party to adapt their thing for public. And Line Wobbler is a good example. Robin had made this great game. We saw it at a game festival. We said this would be awesome in our park. And then we built the physical mount and helped to sort of ruggedize the controller to put it in public. Because, you know, when you put things in public, it's got to be bulletproof. You know, yeah. You've got people day in and day out using it, you know, 10 hours a day, you know, 7 days a week. It's really got to be, you know, built for that kind of abuse. So we would work with developers to adapt their stuff. And then the third is curation, where we'll basically find something that we love and they've already done the ruggedization and you know, we'll put it into the park. And so, but those three, you know, create, collaborate, and curate have been, you know, kind of an underpinning for us from the beginning.
So Brent, I know, you know, we don't have too much time left, but I wanted to make sure we get a few important things in. You actually, even as a startup, have a foundation that you guys actually run. And so most people are like, wait, most startups need money from foundations. They don't usually go and create foundations to give money or resources away. So, but I know it's been incredibly important and successful. So can you talk a little bit about what is this foundation thing and why did you decide to do that while you're busy creating a whole new category of startup called micro amusement parks?
Well, you know, while we were doing that carnival, that traveling carnival, it's called STEAM Carnival for Science, Technology, Engineering, Art, and Math. And the carnival was basically one half a bunch of high-tech entertainment that we'd made, and then one half a bunch of hands-on projects where kids could learn about programming, electronics, and all the STEAM disciplines. And the message was, we built all this stuff. It's not that hard. You can too. Here's how. And so we were kind of taking the fun and the excitement of the games as a hook to be able to get kids excited about science and engineering. And after doing the carnival, we realized, gosh, you know, there's really two things happening here. There's all these people that want to come for all the high-tech entertainment. There's all these people that want to come for this kind of innovation and learning. They're almost different. They're sort of related, but they sort of are different. And so after we did our carnival in San Francisco, that was when we basically split the company in two. And we said, there's going to be one group that's going to build entertainment in micro amusement parks. There's going to be another group that's going to focus on using the learnings from the first group to adapt that to learning, you know, solutions for K through 12. And what's happened is it's just gone like wildfire. Since then, we've acquired 3 nonprofits. I didn't know that could happen, but yeah, nonprofits merge all the time. In fact, there's funding out there to do it because there's far too many nonprofits. But you know, lots of passionate folks that really, you know, care about education and learning. And so we now have this complete alternative for the science fair. Kids learn how to make their own games and then throw their own carnival. We provide a full stack solution. The materials the kids use is upcycled trash that we get from companies, extra bottle caps that haven't been used, but we're gonna be thrown away into a landfill, extra cutouts from, you know, the packaging company or from fabric companies. So we provide the physical materials. We provide the tools, basically a makerspace. The curriculum, and then the whole template for how to throw the event. As a result, we're in half the schools in Los Angeles and tons of countries. We're in every state in the union, and it's really been working well. People, you know, we started live streaming hands-on projects every day since the pandemic, and you know, we got a whole dedicated team. It's really it was something that was super important to Eric and I. We're both STEAM trained nerds, and you know, felt like that was a way that we could really you know, have some real impact. We run a circus. It's a lot of fun. It can be a thing that it helps us meet kids where they are. Right? Hey, you like fun? You like circus? You like games? Here's how you can do it yourself. And so that was
That's awesome. That's amazing. By the way, one of the things, because you guys used the term micro amusement parks, and you know, I feel like the Disneyland parks is just like an incredible machine. And not only just from, you know, obviously the business side of it, but how, you know, kids react. And I have a toddler, and I've yet to take her to Disneyland because she's less than two right now, but I'm sure she will want to get there soon. So how do you guys feel about Disneyland? Is that something that will only happen once in the history of mankind, or is what Disneyland has something that's replicable in a different, obviously there's Disney World and Disneyland, but that whole Disney experience in an amusement park, is that ever, like, what do you guys think of that? And is that something that can be created again in a different way?
You want to take that?
Yeah, I think what is magical about Disneyland has been recreated around the globe many, many, many times. And the juggernaut that is Disney, it's a juggernaut because they have so many other things that work together. You know, they're integrated. They got the movies and they got the toys and they got the ESPNs and all that stuff. But in terms of fun in a physical space, there are hundreds of places around the world that are fun. Mm-hmm. And there'll be more, you know?
And I would say I'm obsessed with Disney. I've gone to Epcot by myself, and you know, I mean, I just absolutely think that, you know, what they do is magical, and you know, the level of quality and you know, I mean, in depth, you know, you can see it in the you know, the Star Wars land, you know, I mean, there's backstory and meta games and so much, you know, beauty, you know, in those installations. And I agree with Eric, there's so much great creativity happening all over the place. And, you know, I mean, there's literally a live action video game called Bodaborg in Sweden that I just can't wait to go do. And another thing called Prison Island, which I don't even know what that is, but it sounds wild. you know, there's lots of weird happening all over the place, which I think is, you know, when there's no pandemic, it's a great time to be.
Okay.
If anybody can figure out how to get there during a pandemic, you do it.
So let me ask you guys, what, Eric, I'll start with you. What is your favorite game? It can't be the one that's in 2-Bit Circus, but is okay. Hands down.
Yeah, you know, well, I'll tell you what I've been obsessed with for the last couple of days, and it sort of speaks to a little bit more of my personality. I've been flying simulated RC aircraft for the past week, and I cannot put the controller down. And I think what appeals to me about it is that it's very self-directed, and I can play the same challenge 1,000 times until I get it right. And I feel like I'm definitely building a skill as I play. So is that relevant to anything else that we've been talking? No, but taken alone, the answer to that question is, I'm liking playing the RC simulator right now.
Okay, very good. How about you, Brent? Your favorite game in the world?
Man, it's such a hard question because I'm obsessed with games. My family, we play games all the time. You know, family dinners, you know, board game nights. So, you know, I have a massive closet full of games, but I love Dungeons and Dragons.
that's a solid one.
The last night we played. And it's, you know, the thing that's so powerful about it is it's a customized story just for you, right? You know, I mean, you and your friends are sitting there, you've got the Dungeon Master who is an interactive, you know, narrator that is, you know, that's really special. And you know, you've maybe been to immersive theater, right? This new category that's not just sitting in a theater seat and facing a stage, but the theater is all around you and you have to sort of wander around and be curious to figure out what's happening. And you know, Sleep No More in New York is a popular one, but there's lots of stuff that's starting to happen in that space. And D&D is sort of the like OG immersive theater. You know, this was when you know, in the very beginning, you were having these conversations. It's, you know, it's campfire storytelling, but you get to take on a whole new role and be this weird character. And, you know, I mean, they're really, it's really magical.
Nice. So a couple more. So 5 years from now, like, what does the world look like, right, with the pandemic and in terms of entertainment? Is this a blip on the radar for you guys, do you think, or have fundamentally things have changed? And what does that world look like in 5 years from your perspective in the, for the world of entertainment?
You know, it's interesting just seeing Eric nodding. I actually do think it's somewhat of a blip, you know, and I think it's interesting, you know, we have slightly different perspectives, but the, you know, obviously we're never going to forget this. And oh my God, there's, you know, and we will have for sure in a go forward way. I think that, you know, there are people that are more at risk to viruses, and that's going to be an accessibility thing. We'll make sure that we have play from home solutions, and some people who don't care, who couldn't care less and want to go out and they, you know, can be allowed to do that in a safe way. And so I think being able to, you know, just like you might have a ADA accessible ramp, you know, having options for people who don't feel comfortable to go out in public is going to be important and something that we'll support. But, you know, I think in general, humans are social. All the things, all the sort of trends that were at our backs, you know, pushing us to expand and, you know, are all as true as they've ever been. And, you know, people are going to be back together playing live. And that's either going to be, we figure out being able to test people every single day at low cost. We find a vaccine. That, you know, there are paths out of this. Other countries are back to normal. You know, we'll get there too the second we, well, that's a different podcast.
Okay. Eric, what about you? You disagree a little bit.
Oh, I think that, I mean, you'll hear it all over the place that this pandemic has accelerated trends that were happening in the world already. And there will be no reversing those trends. I think, I don't know. I can't tell you what will happen in the world, but I can certainly tell you what will happen for us in our business. I really think that this will change us for the better. You know, we are going to have the kind of interactive playground that Brent's been talking about for years, where some of our guests are just always at home and they're having just as good a time and they're interacting with people who are at the park, and those walls are getting more porous, and that's a good thing. And, you know, hey, I don't like this pandemic, but there is going to be some good that came of it.
Yeah. Okay. So last words of advice, you know, you guys have been through an incredible journey and just freaking cool stuff, you know, and for those of you who haven't been yet, I mean, Two Bit Circus is like nothing you've ever seen before, and you just kind of have to go there to really understand it, but it is super cool. I think you'd agree, right, Mike Chivas?
Definitely. Yeah. I can't wait to get back.
Me too. So anyway, it's like, and you guys sort of willed it to happen. Like, words of advice that you would give to the future entrepreneurs listening to this. You gave a little bit before, you know, what are some advice, words of wisdom you guys can impart on our listeners on if they have a dream, like how do they make it happen?
You know, I'm going to riff on something that Eric had said earlier, which, you know, to the tune of getting out there and trying something immediately. And you know, there is no shortage of hard problems out there in the world. And you know, we need people solving, you know, just open a newspaper to figure out all the different ways in which, you know, humanity has got issues. And so, you know, what we have a lack of are talented, capable people going out to solve those problems. And so I think my one bit of advice would be to, like, think big. You know, a lot of folks, you know, the number of times I've gone to university startup pitches and they're doing candy delivery to your dorm or something stupid that nobody needs, you know, I mean, that's not a problem. Okay, maybe that's a problem five people have, but, you know, let's solve the huge problems. You know, I mean, there's just, that's the stuff that we really need people's eyes and attention on.
Very good.
Not another app.
I can't argue one bit with that. That's great advice. Think big, but also start small. Take that big problem and find the piece of it that you can do right now, tonight. Yeah. Yeah. And do it and test it. And then there'll be another piece you can do tomorrow. And eventually, you'll have a thing. It'll be awesome.
And you know, after trying something and doing it today and then tomorrow and then the next day, you know, after 6 months, you're getting to be an expert at that thing. Even if all 6 months of tests failed, you're going to know a lot of ways not to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that, those words mean a lot from guys who've actually done exactly what you have, I think, advised this for us to do. So I totally enjoyed the chat. You know, I think that you coined the term, I think, micro amusement.
Yeah, Mark, you made it
and,
up.
And I think that that's a really interesting concept. I think as, you know, things like retail and malls, unfortunately, you know, accelerate sort of their relevance in the world, at least in the way they are, you know, facilities and entertainment venues like yours could help fill that gap and, you know, hopefully bring the world closer together as you outlined. So I'm a huge fan of what you guys do. And I hope you guys continue that passion forward, and you know we'll be counting the days until we can get back in there, and sort of you know. And I know you have national expansion aspirations as well, so that listeners who are unfortunately not able to visit in Los Angeles, hopefully there's a two-bit circus coming to you, right, Brent? You want to talk a little bit about that, or too early?
You know, it's a little early, but I will say we've taken all the steps to, you know, ensure that Two-Bit's going to reopen, and you know, we are well positioned to expand this thing. And what we've built is something that we believe can work in, you know, scores of U.S. cities. So we're very excited for this next phase.
Sweet. Cool. So Mike, another interesting interview. Any last parting words of advice from you?
For these guys, just keep building. Just keep up the madness.
Thanks, man.
Yeah. Well, thank you, sir.
Come join us on our game show, you guys. Next show is you know, we're on every Thursday at 7 o'clock. And chances are, or with certainty, there'll be new features the next time you come.
Awesome.
Okay, we'll be there.
Thank you so much, guys, for your time. We really enjoyed it.
Thank you, guys.
And thank
Great
you.
Talking with you as well.
Appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks a lot, guys. Okay.